was watching me. A nondescript face, a nondescript suit, a face in the crowd. Except he wasn't in the crowd. He was sitting opposite and watching me. Any moment he would speak. Any subject would do, the war, the weather. Just so long as he could engage me in conversation.
Cigarette?
No, thank you.
You don't mind if I...
No, no.
Tobacco is one of my weaknesses. I suppose it'll be rationed if the war goes on for any time.
I expect so.
I couldn't bear that. Grounds for surrender. Every man has a breaking point.
Perhaps.
I wonder what happened to all the idealists and pacifists. They seem to have disappeared now that war's been declared.
Does it matter?
Well, it might be interesting to get in touch with some of them. Some of the more interesting ones.
You mean fascists?
Yes. After all, Hitler does have some valid points, and the fascists would be the only ones to understand him. Well, we need understanding now more than anything else, don't you think?
All right, Tom. I can understand how you feel, but you really can't blame them. They have to be sure.
You mean you have to be sure?
Now, listen, Tom. As far as I'm concerned, you're just the sort of man we need, but you must realize that your qualifications... The fact that you can speak fluent German, that you were educated in Germany, that you're personally acquainted with Hitler and his followers, these things are all in your favor. But they also count against you.
And in the meantime, I have to put up with your people spying on me, sidling up to me in trains and asking me if I can put them in touch with the Nazis.
Now, just be patient. The war's only been going for a few weeks and nothing seems to be happening. It could be that in another month or so, the whole thing might fizzle out.
But it didn't fizzle out. And the question I kept asking myself was, have I been cleared now? Would they be ready to use me? Then came a message from Duff Cooper, the new Minister of Information. Would I be prepared to help improve BBC broadcasts to Germany by doing one or two talks a week myself? I couldn't have felt more exhilarated if I'd been given a knighthood. I immediately rushed to the Daily Express office to secure the permission of Arthur Christensen, my editor.
Go ahead, Tom. It's a fine idea. I'll print some of your talks. Some of them may even be news.
My first German language transmission was news. It coincided with Hitler's triumphal Reichstag speech, celebrating his victory over France. I listened to it over a loudspeaker in the BBC studio.
Und Herr Churchill, sollte mir dieses Mal vielleicht ausnahmsweise glauben, wenn ich als Prophet jetzt folgendes ausspreche.
Mr. Churchill ought for once to believe me when I prophesy that a great empire will be destroyed, which it was never my intention to destroy or even harm. In this hour, I feel it my duty before my conscience to appeal once more to reason and common sense in Britain. I can see no reason why this war must go on.
Within an hour of Hitler having spoken, I was before the microphone ready to deliver my first talk.
On the air in 5 seconds. Quiet in the studio, please.
Herr Hitler, you have, on occasion in the past, consulted me as to the mood of the British public. So permit me to render Your Excellency this little service once again, to tell you what we think of this appeal of yours. We hurl it right back at you. Right in your evil-smelling teeth.
Very good, Tom. Not in the diplomatic tradition of the BBC, but very good.
Will the minister explain why Sefton Delmer, a Daily Express journalist of no importance, was allowed to deliver an answer to Hitler without the authority of this house? Surely responsibility for answering an offer by a head of state rests with the Prime Minister or Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs.
There was a sinister German reaction. Himmler added a name to the list of persons who were to be arrested following the invasion of Britain.
Sefton Delmer, number 33. Paris representative of the Daily Express, to be handed over to Department 4B4 of the Central Reich Security Office.
A few weeks later, with a threatened invasion imminent, I was again on the air to Germany. This time my talk was an educational broadcast, a harmless lesson in English.
On the air in 5 seconds. Quiet in the studio, please.
We English, as you know, are notoriously bad at languages. And so it'd be best if you learn a few useful English phrases before visiting us. For your first lesson, we will take die Kanalüberfahrt, the channel crossing. The channel crossing. Now, repeat after me, das Boot sinkt. The boat is sinking. Das Wasser ist kalt. The water is cold. Now, I'll give you a verb that should come in useful. Again, please repeat after me. Ich brenne. I burn. Du brennst. You burn. Er brennt. He burns. Wir brennen. We burn. Ihr brennt. You are burning. And if I may be allowed to suggest a phrase, der SS-Sturmführer brennt auch ganz schön. The SS captain is also burning quite nicely. The SS captain is also burning quite nicely. Well, I had tried. That little lesson fitted in with our stories about setting the sea on fire. But the BBC's ideas on sound broadcasting to Germany did not coincide with mine. I couldn't change the BBC, and I wasn't going to let them change me. So what was I to do now? I desperately wanted to help in the fight against Hitler, but it seemed that the powers that be still had misgivings about using me because of my German background. Back to the Daily Express.
I want you to go to Lisbon to investigate these stories that Hitler and Franco are planning an assault on Gibraltar.
Lisbon was the transit point for thousands of German Jews fleeing Hitler's tyranny. From them, I was able to pick up a great deal of interesting information and colorful gossip. I learned the names of foremen, engineers, and Nazi party officials in the munitions workshops. I learned what they'd been making. I learned many of the new German wartime expressions. But above all, I got the feel of life in Hitler's wartime Reich. A telegram arrived from Leonard Ingrams, the man who had advised me to be patient.
Suggest you return London early as possible and resign from Express. Important job awaits you. Propaganda broadcast to Germany.
Oh, no, Leonard. The BBC and I just don't see eye to eye.
I'm not talking about working for the BBC, Tom. I'm talking about the Department of Psychological Warfare setting up its own station.
The BBC would never tolerate that. They regard the ether as their own personal property.
Oh, the battle will be next week at the meeting. You're to address it. Gentlemen, Mr. Sefton Delmer. I believe he is known to some of you.
He's known to the BBC, Mr. Chairman.
Gentlemen, I have made an analysis of BBC talks in German transmitted between October the 26th and December the 6th, 1940. Ideological humanitarian appeal to the Germans accounted for 21% of the output. Reasoned argument, 32%. 35% looked forward to a revolution against Hitler, and 12% assumed an audience of anti-Nazi sympathizers. Now, I know Germany, gentlemen, and I know the German mind. Attempts to persuade Germans to rise up against Hitler are a waste of breath and electricity. What I'm suggesting is a new psychological weapon which operates outside the strictures.
You mean a new radio station operating outside the control of the BBC?
Basically, yes, but
I'm afraid it's quite out of the question.
I think we should hear Mr. Delmer's proposals before arriving at any conclusions.
The idea is to try out what we call black propaganda on the Germans. The proposed station will undermine Hitler by pretending to be all for him and his war.
Oh. Really? I've never heard such an absurd idea.
The German listener will be twiddling the dial on his radio, and suddenly find himself tuned into what sounds like clandestine signals traffic of a military organization sending ciphered instructions to its secret cells all over occupied Europe. In between the messages, a diehard of the old Prussian school will broadcast outspoken views of what's going on, spiced with plenty of inside information. His views will show him to be absolutely loyal and devoted to the Führer, but scathingly contemptuous of the rabble that has seized control of the Fatherland in the Führer's name. And all the time, the German listener will believe he's eavesdropping on broadcasts not intended for his ears.
Well, the proposal is approved, then.
One query, Mr. Chairman. I take it this new station will limit its activities to the short wave band.
We'd reach a much larger audience on the medium wave.
It's supposed to be a clandestine military station. The military use shortwave, therefore it would be more realistic if this new station stuck to the shortwave.
Shortwave would be useless if we want to reach an audience.
I think we'll be happy to compromise on using the shortwave band, don't you agree, Tom?
Yes.
Well, then, that's settled. Go to it, then, Tom. It's a great chance to show your ingenuity. There are no limits, no holds barred.
That was the beginning of a legend which I would find reverberating in Germany long after the war was over. Operating from Woburn Abbey, we went on the air for the first time on the evening of May the 23rd, 1941. My die-hard Prussian was Paul Sanders, a Berliner who had earned his living as a writer of detective stories before he turned his back on Germany and came to England. He was to be called Der Chef, the Chief. Recent events had given Der Chef a heaven-sent subject for his first broadcast, the flight of Rudolf Hess to Britain.
First, let's get this straight. This fellow is by no means the worst of the lot. He was a good comrade of ours in the days of the Free Corps. But like the rest of this clique of cranks, megalomaniacs, string pullers, and parlor Bolsheviks who call themselves our leaders, he has no nerves for a crisis. Something goes wrong, and what happens? He flies off to throw himself and us on the mercy of that flat-footed bastard of a drunken old Jew, Churchill. If the obscene, grasping toads of our security services had been doing their job instead of fornicating and gorging themselves on supplies intended for our soldiers, then they would have stopped the poor idiot in time.
The phrase about Churchill, which cost no broken bones, established us with our German listeners as a genuine German station.
Do you know how those loathsome, lecherous lizards at Admiral Dönitz's headquarters are repaying our glorious U-boat crews in their heroic battle against Churchill's navy? Do you? These odorous Bolshevik newts, hiding like the cowardly swine they are in German uniforms, are using the wives of U-boat officers to gratify their villainous lusts and perversions in return for a promise to send their husbands to safe training posts on the Baltic.
As we gradually built up our records, so our stories became more credible with the German public.
The wives of party officials in the Schleswig-Holstein area are buying up all the woolen goods they can lay their hands on. Why? Because these traitorous whores have learned from their husbands that our fatherland's supplies of textiles are running out. And anyone not using their coupons now won't be able to buy anything later on.
We learned later that this broadcast stimulated a wave of panic buying. It was black propaganda at its best when it made people do things detrimental to their own war effort. From prisoners of war, we learned that Der Chef was reaching an extremely wide audience. All manner of rumors were circulating around Germany as to his real identity and the site of his clandestine transmitter. Unfortunately, we were too good. We managed to see reports being sent home from the Berlin embassy of the still neutral United States.
It is evident that there has been a dramatic increase in the hostility of the German army to the Nazi Party since the invasion of Russia. The army have gone so far as to set up a radio transmitter from which a nameless officer, referred to as the Chef, is broadcasting violent attacks on certain sections of the party. An ever-increasing number of Germans are listening to these broadcasts, and attempts by the German government to locate the transmitter and close it down have so far failed.
We had fooled the Americans, the last people we wanted to fool. We didn't want them to think that they only had to sit on the fence for a few more months and Hitler would eventually be overthrown by his own army. It was decided that David Bowes Lyon should visit President Roosevelt to explain about Dershev. He wondered what the president's reaction would be when he learned that his agents had been misled by the British.
It's very good of you to see me, sir, so I'll get straight to the point and not waste too much of your time. We understand that your Berlin embassy has been forwarding reports that anti-Nazi elements in the German army, led by an officer known as Der Chef, have been broadcasting violent attacks on the Nazi party, and that these attacks have increased in severity since Hitler's invasion of Russia. I have to inform you, sir, that this station is being operated from England by His Majesty's government. It transmits anti-Nazi propaganda whilst pretending to be all for Hitler and his works. It was not our intention to mislead our friends. We would be most grateful, sir, if you would tell no one else of it.
Unfortunately, Roosevelt was so amused, he was unable to keep the story to himself, and within a few days it was all over Washington. Despite this, it was America which was to provide the means to increase the black propaganda war against Germany to an intensity undreamed of when Der Chef started his broadcasts in 1941. Brigadier Gambier Parry, the head of the Intelligence Services Communications Branch, visited the United States to see what he could find in the way of transmitting equipment. He returned very pleased with himself.
Well, gentlemen, my trip was quite successful. In fact, it was most successful. I have purchased a transmitter. It was on offer by the Radio Corporation of America. HMG put in a bid, and it's now ours. The BBC want to use it to intrude on German broadcast, inject a few rude comments and so on.
A waste of time.
This isn't one of your 15-kilowatt squawk boxes. It's nearly 750,000 watts. A raiding dreadnought of the ether, reaching into every occupied corner of Europe, firing massive electronic broadsides at the enemy, and blasting Dr. Goebbels' eardrums. I've called it Aspidistra.
It's the biggest Aspidistra in the world.
Late in 1942, Donald McLaughlin of the Naval Intelligence Department concocted a brilliant scheme which he put to me over lunch in a London restaurant.
We're anxious to step up the psychological war against the U-boat crews. Now, it's vital that we do everything possible to crack their morale. So what would you say to a special station beamed at them?
Broadcasting live black propaganda news bulletins?
Yeah. With music, greetings from home, everything.
Oh, it's what I've always wanted to do.
Excellent. We'll call it Radio Atlantic.
On medium wave?
It's useless for U-boats. Yeah. It'll have to be short wave. I understand you have a powerful transmitter. Aspidistra?
It's on loan to the BBC. Now they regard it as theirs.
We'll have to prize it from them somehow. You put the idea up, and in the meantime, I'll arrange for some influential people to pull a few strings, including those attached to the BBC.
Okay, but if we can get Aspidistra, we could go the whole hog and broadcast to the whole of Germany. Really lively stuff. Human interest stories interlaced with good music. The sort the Germans like. And our black news stories. It'd have the Germans listening to it because it was an entertaining station. On medium wave.
That's an excellent idea. I wonder what the BBC will think of it.
It was a battle the BBC lost. They also lost Aspidistra, and we had to lose Der Chef. For 2.5 years, he had continued to defy the Gestapo and burn up the ether with his sulphurous broadcasts. Now we had a new job for him. It was time the Gestapo caught up with the rogue and silenced him for good.
Our brave soldiers have another enemy to contend with. The scurrilous, conniving pimps of the corrupt party crowd who are delaying the supply of warm clothing to the front, where our courageous sons are dying in their thousands. Not from Bolshevik bullets, but at the hands of these despicable swine sitting at home in soft jobs, feathering their own foul-smelling nests far from danger and privation.
Sir, there are men outside. Gestapo. You must flee.
Let the pox-infested vermin in. Let them see what a true patriot of the fatherland looks like. Long live the Führer!
Perhaps our acting wasn't up to the standard of BBC radio drama, but if my head wasn't to be exhibited on a plate in the BBC canteen, it was essential that the programmes from Aspidistra were first class in their own right. We had smart new studios at Milton Bryan, and prefabricated buildings were erected in the 5-acre grounds to house the talented team of former U-boat men, Luftwaffe pilots, ex-members of the SS, Jews, Catholics, Protestants, if only Hitler could have seen them, all functioning together as one close-knit team with a common purpose, the destruction of Hitler and all his works. Whilst preparations at the Milton Bryan studios forged ahead with meticulous attention to detail, Harold Robin, our chief engineer and high priest of Aspidistra, worked round the clock on last-minute adjustments.
It was so large, it needed its own water supply to cool the transmission valves.
We have to get it watered by the local fire brigade. So they've put the water rates up half a crown. The roots stop up the drains, grow along the country lanes, and they come up half a mile outside the town.
On the evening of the 24th of October, 1943, we were ready.
Quiet in the studio, please. We're on the air in 5 seconds from now. Good luck, everyone.
Aspidistra, the most powerful transmitter in Europe, took a deep breath and...
Here is the Soldiers' Radio Calais. Broadcasting on 360 meters, 410 meters, and 492 meters in the medium waveband. And not forgetting our comrades in the U-boat service, we are linking up with Radio Atlantic on 30.7 and 48.3 meters shortwave to bring news, music, and greeting to all our comrades in the fighting services wherever you may be. Some news in a moment, but in the meantime, here is some dance music.
Such presentation seems commonplace today, but to the German public, brought up on a dreary diet of Dr. Goebbels' propaganda, it was sensational. They accepted it at its face value as a German station and listened with wonder and pleasure.
It shot up like a rocket till it nearly touched the sky. It's the biggest Aspidistra in the world.
It was an exotic plant, but its perfume, wafting across Germany and seeping into the minds of its unsuspecting listeners, was to prove deadly.
A reassuring message for all fathers has been received from the Administrative Authority for Children's Evacuation Camps. Thanks to the magnificent efforts of the Reich Medical Service, children's deaths due to the diphtheria epidemic have dropped from a weekly average of 548... to 372. Despite the acute shortage of doctors and medical supplies, it is hoped to hold this figure during the next few weeks. And now, some more music.
The German public, listening to the Soldiers' Radio Calais, decided that radio intended for their soldiers had to be more honest because the military, directly involved in the war, could not be fooled as easily as civilians.
The 500 Anglo-American terror bombers which attacked Hamburg last night, causing widespread damage to the docks and killing 231 expectant mothers in the maternity hospital, paid dearly for their atrocity. Five of them were shot down by our brave Luftwaffe fighter pilots.
Despite its size and power, Aspidistra possessed considerable electronic agility. It could hop all over the waveband, hotly pursued in full hue and shriek by German jamming stations vainly trying to drown its stentorian voice. Harold Robin could change wavelengths in a fraction of a second, a task normally requiring several hours. One of the most attentive, but not most enthusiastic, of our German listeners was Dr. Goebbels. He wrote in his diary,
"In the evening, the so-called soldiers' radio Calais, which evidently originates in England, has given us something to worry about. The station does a very clever job of propaganda, and from what is out on the air, one can gather that the British know exactly what they have destroyed and what they have not."
In order to provide a fast news distribution service over Hitler's far-flung territories, he'd set up a wireless teleprinter service, and we were fortunate enough to possess one of his receiving machines, which gave us a steady stream of promotions and decorations in the German army and the texts of official speeches, sometimes before they were officially read. Much to the alarm of Himmler's security service, as reports from worried officials flooded into their office.
"They all begin meowing when the buds begin to sprout up the biggest aspidistra in the world."
"From Bavarian State Ministry of the Interior, March 16th, 1944. Subject, the effect of the soldiers' radio Calais on the population. This station has been causing the greatest unrest and confusion. It transmits short but scurrilous news items between pleasing music, so that even the slowest mind can digest what it has heard before the next item is dished up. It also reads out official communiques and decrees before they are transmitted on our radio, thus achieving considerable credibility with uninitiated listeners. The population now believe our jammer is a British attempt to silence Calais."
The report went on to say that soldiers' radio Calais had become one of the three most popular stations in the area.
"The dogs line up for miles and miles, a funny sight to see. They sniff around for hours on end and wag their tails with glee."
Whilst Aspidistra's subtle poison was creeping like an invisible Trojan horse into the subconscious of the unsuspecting German civilian population, Radio Atlantic, also broadcasting from Aspidistra, was helping to widen the crack in the morale of Hitler's U-boat men. By 1944, it was a yawning fissure.
"Radio Atlantic sends its heartiest congratulations to the 7th Flotilla football team for their well-earned 4-1 win over the 3rd Flotilla. Top scorer was torpedo officer Hans Braun, who, judging by his last report, is better at shooting penalties than he is at firing torpedoes. And now, a special request for Captain Wolfgang Weiner and his crew, who left Lorient yesterday on a top-secret mission."
After his capture, one U-boat officer told his interrogators,
"We had sailed under all the usual secrecy, strict radio silence and all that, but we hadn't been at sea 2 days when the Radio Atlantic calls us and plays us some special music. It's a very unpleasant sensation to feel that you're being watched and that the enemy knows exactly where you are."
A great deal of our inside knowledge about the U-boat crews was received from the Director of Naval Intelligence. He arranged for his French agents working on the Atlantic U-boat bases to send trivial information, even gossip.
"And now, a Brahms lullaby for Captain Mole's U-boat, in the hope that it will help preserve the peace aboard, in case the captain has discovered that the man who's been sleeping with his wife is his own first officer."
Radio Atlantic had another little trick. By careful study, we had calculated the tonnage a commander had to sink before Admiral Dönitz conferred the appropriate decoration.
Admiral Dönitz has just notified Radio Atlantic that Commander Karl Schulke is to receive the oak leaves to his Knight's Cross. All of us at Radio Atlantic send our warmest regards on your magnificent achievement, and special regards from me, Vicky.
The treacle in her voice would never let you suspect that this siren had lost half her family in the gas chambers of Auschwitz. The best scheme we devised for Aspidistra's 600-kilowatt voice was so revolutionary, it required approval from the highest level. It was refused.
Cheer up, Tom. Normally, schemes such as yours are turned down flat. At least you've got approval to carry it out on a limited scale.
They have diluted it.
Now, look, Tom, it would not be a good thing for the Germans to be able to declare after the war that they were defeated by a trick. Don't worry. What they've said you can do should do untold damage.
Aspidistra had been successfully posing as a genuine German radio station. Now it was to actually become a genuine station. Not just one, but all of them. Again, it was Dr. Goebbels who was to help in this operation. In their search for perfect organization, all his radio stations across Germany formed a single network broadcasting the same program. Unlike the BBC, each station had its own wavelength. Monitoring them at Milton Bryan sounded like this. Hamburg. Munich. Cologne. As our bombers flew across Germany, stations in their path would go off the air to deny the raiders a homing beacon. Other stations not in the flight path would continue broadcasting. With advanced knowledge of the night's target, our plan was for Aspidistra to lie in wait for a station expected to go off the air, and as soon as it did so, Aspidistra would collect the signal from a station still broadcasting and relay it over the vacant wavelength of the German target station. The German listener, not having touched the tuning dial of his wireless, would continue to hear his favorite music. We would continue the relay for a few moments and then interrupt the program with our own version of a special announcement that the German authorities were fond of making over the radio. After weeks of practice and dummy runs, we were ready. The target for our bombers was Cologne.
Better the way you had it just now. Try it higher up.
Like that?
It's not nearly as good as it sounded before.
The studio manager and the announcer were making last-minute adjustments to a sheet of tinfoil placed before the mic, which would give our announcer's voice the characteristic metallic ring of the announcers on German radio.
It's still not right.
There was a tense atmosphere in the studio, as there always was before a broadcast, but tonight was different. We were going to impersonate a German radio station. The music was coming from Radio Cologne, which was expected to go off the air as our bombers neared their target.
1, 2, 3, 4. How does that sound?
Frightful. Try it the other way.
Then the telephone light was flashing.
Like that?
No, the other way. Will somebody answer that phone? Oh, God, I'm getting to loathe Wagner. I'd take the whole lot over to Mike 4. It's no good you pulling faces at me through the glass. We've got to get it right.
That was Bomber Command, Jeff. The first wave have crossed the Dutch coast and should be over to Cologne in an hour. That was Bomber Command again. They're now 100 miles from Cologne.
Hello, Crowborough. Cologne should go off the air any second now.
We're standing by with our fingers poised on the switches, and we're getting a good strong signal from Munich.
Come on.
What do you think of the signal you're getting now from Cologne?
Good and strong. It's time they're off the air, isn't it?
They are off the air. That's Espedestra you're hearing. We took over exactly 20 seconds ago. So, when you're ready.
Harold Robin had switched Cologne into Espedestra a 200th of a second after its station ceased broadcasting. Several thousand unsuspecting Cologne citizens were now listening to Espedestra. They were at our mercy.
You'll be pleased to know that in 20 seconds, you'll be working for Radio Cologne. Good luck, everyone. Light coming. Fade music. Cue.
We interrupt this program to bring you an urgent announcement at the request of the Reich Security Office. Enemy saboteurs in Wehrmacht uniforms have stolen a field gray car. They have already killed police who tried to stop them. Those of you with arms are authorized to shoot on sight if you see these enemy agents in Wehrmacht officers' uniforms.
Some of Aspidistra's intrusions were cruel hoaxes.
Special food supplies are being distributed from welfare trains calling at the following stations.
Right up to the departure of the first waves of the D-Day invasion force, the propaganda batteries under my command kept up their softening up barrage.
From reports reaching us, it seems that the Americans have supplied their new armor-piercing phosphorus shell to the Russians. The penetrating power of this invincible new weapon is terrifying. Nothing can stop it. It can break through the thickest steel armor and the toughest reinforced ferro-concrete and burn up everything inside.
There was no such shell, but the Germans believed there was. At the Cherbourg perimeter, the American advance was blocked by the general commanding the Fort du Roule.
You and your men have put up a gallant fight, but your position is hopeless. The only thing for you to do is surrender while there is still time. Otherwise, you and your men will be destroyed.
Oh, come on. What's the matter with him?
Do you hear me, General? You must surrender.
There's someone up there with a megaphone, sir.
If you don't surrender, General, you will be destroyed.
I cannot surrender. My orders are to fight to the last man and the last cartridge.
That's exactly what will happen, General. It will be a senseless waste of your men's lives.
If you could prove that my position is hopeless, if you could fire one of those phosphorus shells...
What phosphorus shells?
It's a crazy rumor the Germans have been putting about. Okay, lob him a howitzer.
White flag, sir.
In the closing weeks of the war, I felt tired. My brain, after 5 years' unceasing strain, dreaming up and implementing new ideas for the psychological warfare battleground, was a mass of frayed nerves. Aspidistra continued to intrude on German radio, but I was unable to conceive an imaginative purpose for it. Perhaps it was my disappointment at not being allowed to use Aspidistra to end the war.
It would not be a good thing for the Germans to be able to declare after the war that they had been defeated by a trick.
It was Churchill who came up with an idea for Aspidistra, an idea that was to help collapse what little organization was left in Germany and destroy the remaining shreds of civilian morale.
First
first and second waves are 150 miles from Berlin.
Hello, Cobra. The first and second waves
Berlin
are
off the air. Aspidistra has just taken over.
Thank you, Cobra. On the air in 10 seconds, studio. Light coming in 5 seconds from now. Fade music.
This is Radio Berlin. In a few minutes, this station is going off the air. Here is an urgent bulletin. Thousands of enemy terror bombers are approaching the city. Intelligence reports say Berlin is to be completely destroyed. Everyone must leave the city. Do not use the air raid shelters when you hear the sirens. Repeat, do not use the shelters. Leave whatever you are doing. Employees working on public utilities are hereby authorized to leave their posts. You must flee. You must flee or be killed. Special transport facilities are being provided at fire stations, ambulance depots, and anti-aircraft gun batteries. If you cannot reach these points, you must leave by any means possible. This is Radio Hamburg. Thousands of enemy terror bombers are on their way to destroy the city. You must flee. Leave whatever you are doing. Flee. Flee. The whole city is to be burnt to the ground.
This is Radio Frankfurt. This is Radio Frankfurt. This is Radio Frankfurt.
This is Radio Berlin. The enemy is broadcasting counterfeit instructions on our frequencies. Don't be misled by them. Stay where you are.
This is Radio Hamburg. The enemy is broadcasting fake announcements on our frequencies. Do not be misled by them. The enemy wants you to stay in the city so that you will be destroyed. You must flee.
At last, it was over. 5 years of psychological warfare. 5 years of distortions, lies, half-truths. So mixed was the fact and the fiction, I wondered if I would ever again be able to recognize the truth when I saw it. And yet it was a war I had wanted to end with a lie. I wanted to broadcast ceasefire orders to the Germans.
It would not be a good thing for the Germans to be able to declare after the war that they had been defeated by a trick.
There was a chill wind sweeping across Central Europe from the east. What Churchill was to call the Iron Curtain was already descending. A much cruder psychological war. A war with bombast instead of bombs, bulletins instead of bullets, insults instead of incendiaries, was about to begin.
It's the oldest Aspidistra in the world. So we water it with half a pint of Guinness every day. It's the stoutest Aspidistra in the world. The borough council told us that we've got to chop it down. It interferes with aeroplanes that fly above the town. So we sold it to a woodyard for a lousy half a crown. It's the biggest Aspidistra in the world. The biggest Aspidistra in the world.